from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Afghanistan has brought us images of conflict and war from some of the most remote places on Earth, lonely mountain outposts. Future conflict, says my guest this hour, David Kilcullen, will look a lot more like Nairobi last week. Intensely urban and just intense, a surging global population is making vast, dense megacities, concentrating everything, including potential conflict. This hour on Point, David Kilcullen on the age of the megacity and the urban guerrilla. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. What will it take to make peaceful megacities? What could we face if we don't? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later in this hour, we will hear from Mark Bowden, big thinker and author of Black Hawk Down and The Finish, The Killing of Osama bin Laden. Later this week marks the 20th anniversary of the Battle of Mogadishu, where the Black Hawk went famously down. But first, joining me now from New York is David Kilcullen. Kilcullen served 24 years in the Australian Army, soared to international prominence as a counterinsurgency thinker and advisor, and in the years of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. He was special advisor for counterinsurgency to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, senior counterinsurgency advisor to General David Petraeus in the Iraq surge, counterinsurgency advisor to NATO in 2009 and 10 in Afghanistan. He co-wrote the U.S. Army's 2006 Counterinsurgency Field Manual, author of The Accidental Guerrilla and Counterinsurgency Today. He's the founder and chief executive of Kairos Associates, an advisory group focused on city design and security in the developing world. His new book is Out of the Mountains, The Coming Age of the Urban Guerrilla. David Kilcullen, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. It's wonderful to be here.
Was Nairobi Exhibit A last week, the Terror Mall?
Nairobi is a really good example of some of the new options that are open to non-state armed groups of all kinds, including terrorists, that come about not only because of urbanization and because of the rapid growth of slums. You know, 60% of the population of Nairobi lives in less than 5% of the city's land area, but also because of dramatic increases in connectivity in the last decade. And I think that's the really new factor that we're looking at here.
Paint the global kind of a population picture that's got your attention in the coming years. You're looking at megacities where and what's happening there?
Well, if we start the clock running at the beginning of the European Industrial Revolution in 1750, at that time, the population of the planet was about 750 million people, and about 3% of people on the planet at that time lived in a city of a million or more. What we've seen since then is this radical acceleration and growth, both in global population but also in the level of urbanization. So by 1960, the global population had hit 3 billion. It then doubled again to 6 billion by the end of the 20th century. In just the dozen or so years since then, we've added another slightly more than 1 billion people on the planet. And in that time, we've gone from 3% urbanization to 50% urbanization. And when we look forward in the next generation, the best data that we have available right now suggests that there's going to be another 3 billion people just in developing world coastal cities in the next generation. So putting in that in perspective, cities that are currently some of the least well-developed and least well-governed, that in many cases are megacities already that have the infrastructure of a small-sized town, will be swamped by the same number of people that it took all of human history right up until 1960 to generate across the entire planet. So the thesis that I and a lot of other people are putting forward is that, you know, this is going to have some kind of an effect on, frankly, everything, but in particular on conflict. And if we don't get a grip of how these cities grow in a way that brings populations more fully into their own process of development, we could be looking at some pretty significant problems.
I mean, it's easy to imagine this as a violent dystopia. And I want to put you up against a little bit of that imagination, because I'm not sure that's where we want to go. But it's already on lots of filmmakers' minds. We had Elysium this summer, this film, you know, Matt Damon and Jodie Foster. David said in 2154, two classes of people, the very wealthy on a luxurious space station spinning up in the sky, and the poor who live on a violent, overpopulated Earth in the rough ruins of Los Angeles. Here's Max DaCosta, played by Matt Damon, fighting back. Okay, David Kukal, I mean, this is what we don't want. There's Los Angeles. Never mind third world. Los Angeles is this dusty, violent, semi-abandoned, but heavily populated hell. Is that what it has to be?
Absolutely not. It doesn't have to be like that at all. And in fact, what we're talking about here is a projection of current data, not a prediction. And in fact, I think that there's actually a lot of scope for this to be a good thing. I mean, $3 billion new urban dwellers by the middle of the century, that could be 2 billion new people in the global middle class. It could lift millions of people out of poverty. It could lead to enormous improvements in public health and prosperity and education. But only if we understand that these cities are under immense strain from enormous flows of people, and we figure out in enough time how to deal with those. I think a lot of some of the work of guys like Mike Davis, who lives in Hawaii, who's a very prominent urban studies thinker, who's talked about a planet of slums, and he talks about how giant slum areas will fill in the spaces between existing cities even as those cities get bigger. One of the predictions that you see from the Indian government is that by 2040, the entire west coast of India could be one single giant conurbation stretching all the way down the west coast. So these are, like I say, projections. And while there may not be much we can do to prevent or change the scale of the human flow into the urban environment, there's a lot we can do about what happens to people when they get into that environment, and there's a lot we can do about helping cities become more resilient in dealing with that challenge.
I mean, we've had cities for a long time, and big cities, and of course cities come with law enforcement challenges, but we associate you with counterinsurgency, with military and all that. I mean, what's got you in this zone? I mean, why, even if cities are very big, why is this not about just policing and law enforcement? Yes, they're dense, they're big, but we've got New York and Shanghai and many others, and they get along fine.
There's a paradox here, which is that if you look at this from the standpoint of the city itself and the problem of how it copes with its growth, not only are there no military solutions, but I actually spend a lot of the book explaining why the military is probably the worst actor to be involved in trying to fix this kind of problem. You know, armies kill cities. It's just a fact of life. But if you look at it from the standpoint of the military, you can say wherever we're going to be fighting in the future, just simply because the vast majority of people on the planet are going to be living in coastal cities, it's going to look a lot more like Mogadishu, a lot more like Lagos or Mumbai or Karachi than it's going to look like Afghanistan has looked over the last decade. Putting it in the urban services world for a second, It's like the difference between fire prevention and firefighting. If you look at a city, obviously it's much better to deal with the fire code and fire prevention and to stop fires from breaking out in the first place. And that's the most important thing you can do. But we pay fire departments to fight fires. If you're in the military, you've got to be focused on, if we do get dragged into these kinds of environments, how do we operate there? And I think we're coming out of a decade where guys like me and diplomats and aid agency people and the military have focused very much on a particular set of challenges, as you mentioned in your introduction, to do with non-state armed groups in very remote, landlocked areas. And as we come back after Iraq and Afghanistan, we're going to find not only that the future looks quite different, but also that the environment has changed a lot while we've been away. And in the biggest change is that there's this massive explosion in global connectivity, cell phones, satellite television, the internet, that didn't exist 10 years ago. And that fundamentally changes the way that conflict happens. And it has democratized technology to the point where things that police used to be able to handle are now not necessarily in the realms of ordinary policing, because we're looking at much more violent and more developed threats than we might have seen in the past.
Nairobi, an example of that. These seem to be fairly well orchestrated and maybe armed group that came into the big mall.
Yeah, I think Nairobi is an example of something that I talk about extensively in the book, which is this kind of urban siege technique that was pioneered to some extent by Lashkar-e-Taiba during the Mumbai attacks of November 2008, which your listeners probably remember was when the Pakistani terrorist group infiltrated the Indian fishing fleet and landed by inflatable boat in a number of slum areas that were right next to very important downtown infrastructure.
I know that area well in Mumbai, right down by the Taj Hotel and all the rest.
That whole Kalaba Peninsula that I know you know well, and there's this mixed development there, right? And Mumbai is a great example of how an organization that understands the flow of a city can go in and really disrupt that city, you know, deliberately in order to gain an effect. And we've seen what happened in Nairobi. Actually, Shabab issued a comment this week where they acknowledged that they consciously copied Lashkar-e-Taiba's technique in Mumbai in the way that they planned the attack on the Westgate Mall.
David Kilcullen writes that if we want to avoid a future somewhere between Mad Max and Blade Runner, it's going to require creative thinking and determined action, and a good deal of it not military at all, but that's there too. He joins us this hour from New York. His new book is Out of the Mountains, The Coming Age of the Urban Guerrilla, whether it's what we saw in Nairobi or what we'll ask about, a bombing in Boston or Mumbai. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking after Nairobi with counterinsurgency guru David Kilcullen this hour about the world's population and our next conflicts. He says moving to our cities. His new book is Out of the Mountains, The Coming of Age of the Urban Guerrilla. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. In a few minutes, Mark Bowden joins us. This week, the 20th anniversary of the Black Hawk Down incidents that he chronicled so famously in his book of the same name. David Kilcullen, help us get a fix on you. You're now CEO of Kairos. And this is a kind of city design and security advisory group, but I can't figure out if you're a new kind of NGO or a new kind of Blackwater. You've got a lot of military in your background. What is this thing?
Virtually everybody that works at Kairos is ex-aid agency, ex-NGO, or I have a lot of software developers, and we have close partnership with a couple of urban design firms. So we're not in any way a Blackwater. What we do is it's designed to address a particular challenge. So you see in urban design thinking a real development in the last decade of ideas around participatory development and around co-design. So the idea that big planners should not come into some area or any other urban environment and just impose on the community that lives there a solution.
Advised the mall developer in Nairobi and you would have said, like, don't put it there or don't put it in neighborhood, don't put it in Nairobi?
Not exactly. We work in, for example, some slum areas in West Africa. Our client for that work was the World Bank, and we worked a lot with local communities to help them map their environment and using a mapping software that we built to help them figure out where the risks were for them and where they saw the challenges so that they could communicate to their own local government and to the rest of their community what were their priorities and what they wanted to see. Now, the challenge that I see is you have companies like IDEO in California has this idea of human-centered design. You have this idea of co-design, which we talk about in the work that we do. How do you do that when there's a non-state armed group shooting at you? How do you do that in a way that doesn't suck you into a Black Hawk Down or an Iraq kind of situation? And that's the challenge that we focus on. So we're focusing on a set of issues that a lot of other people work on, but we work in a very specific environment, which is conflict-affected and disaster-affected environments where some of the normal techniques don't work. The paradox is that there are no military solutions here, none at all, and we don't do that work at all because we don't see it as a valid solution. But paradoxically, there are no solutions at all without security. Better that security should come from the community itself. And if not from the community itself, then from local police and local government. But there will be times when the international community needs to get involved. We think that's the worst option, but sometimes it's the only choice.
Your company focused on, you're right here on your website, among other things, innovative technologies, research, field teams, systems for vulnerable, insecure, and politically sensitive environments, which you're describing as an awful lot of the world. So help us get a sense of this, because it is easy to picture those dystopian Elysium kind of, you know, blasted, violence-ridden nightmares of the L.A. shown in 2153 there. What do you suggest? You talk about the flow of a city. So you've got a mega city. It's got all kinds of tensions and politics and potential conflict in it. You're talking about non-state actors. I guess you mean Al-Qaeda or Shabab or others like that. Can you just design it so those flow away? Is that what you're saying?
No, it's about working with – firstly, it's about understanding a city as a flow pattern rather than as a piece of urban terrain. So one of the projects we did earlier this year was down in Latin America, where we went to a city in Honduras, which is has the highest murder rate in the world, San Pedro Sula. It's 169 per 100,000 people. For comparison, Baghdad, during the height of the surge when I was there, was only 48. It's an enormous level of people getting murdered. When you look at it from a distance, it looks like a completely random pattern of senseless violence. When you get on the ground and you start to understand how the city flows and how trade goods and people and money and energy and population move through the environment, you quickly work out that there are two or three things causing about 90% of the violence, and that can give you a range of solutions which the community itself and local government can then explore in an intelligent way.
Are you talking about different than policed violence? This is a different quality than muggings, or is it the same?
This is largely gang-on-gang violence, mm-hmm. actually, in the case of San Pedro Sula. Well, I'll give you another example. And I think one of the key elements of the way we think about this is not to think about it as a fundamentally threatening environment. The work that we've done in Liberia, for example, involved putting our own field teams into environments that are too dangerous for the police to go into. These are urban no-go areas where the police don't operate because it's too dangerous. But we're not in that system. And we work with teams that are mixed expat experts and local experts. And we've been able to go into a number of places without a lot of risk because we're not part of a big power struggle for control over those environments. And I think in the case of Mogadishu, which we're going to talk about mm-hmm. a little bit later, mm-hmm. When I was there last year, one of the things that really jumped out at me about the city is how good it is actually to run a business there or to live there now compared to how it's been over the last 20 years. Just one example, the Bacara market, which is a major sure. focus of the fighting during the Black Hawk Down battle. Today, there's a currency exchange on the floor of that market where currency traders trade the Somali shilling, which is a currency that survived for 20 years without a state or a central bank, and it floats on international exchange rates that get updated 5 times a day. And the traders on that floor pump that out by SMS text message to hundreds of traders across the city who all have cell phones. There are 4 major cell phone companies operating just in Mogadishu alone. Yeah. And they do an enormous amount of international trade on this free floating currency. This is all stuff that people yeah. have figured out themselves, you know, without a government.
Oh, we're glad for that, but it's still Mogadishu. I mean, it's been a long time since I was there, but it had to have all kinds of gunmen, cars full, just to move around the city. Here was Nairobi last week. This was Bendita Malakia, an American lawyer in Kenya, describing being trapped in that mall. NBC News.
People are screaming. You hear lots of running. You hear gunshots or explosions. It's complete chaos.
They're not the first city to feel complete chaos. That was a particularly bad version. Here's Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta saying, hey, we've taken care of this.
Ladies and gentlemen, as I had vowed earlier, we have ashamed and defeated our attackers. That part of our task has been completed by our multi-agency security team.
Shamed and defeated, but it was really a mess, and maybe a mess even in its conclusion. Nick in Savannah, Georgia, you're on the air with David Kilcullen. Thanks for calling, Nick.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a professional Army officer with the U.S. Army, and I wanted to speak to a point you made earlier in terms of fighting in landlocked countries versus kind of coastal cities where you have a large population center, large commerce center. I think one of the things, and again, my views are, you know, my own personal views that I've grown
yep.
as an Army officer and not necessarily the views of the Army itself, but mm-hmm. what I see is that we've focused so much energy into learning how to fight a counterinsurgency that we've really stopped, and we're trying to fix it, but it's slow going. We've lost that skill set that's required to fight a big combined arms fight with, you know, using infantry armor, you know, field artillery, all the tools that the U.S. military can bring to bear. We've kind of lost that skill set. It's atrophied, and it's something we can bring back. But I think as we shift towards a more conventional environment to fight in, you know, urban environments, rural environments outside of cities, we're going to find that those skill sets, even if we are fighting, you know, non-governmental actors, we're gonna need those skill sets. And I think it's something that we as a nation, and specifically as a military, need to really focus on in order to move forward and have a successful plan that will allow us to win wars in the future.
And Nick, you're a professional Army guy, and for us civilians, help me out. You're saying don't lose track of artillery and tanks and the big stuff, even as you look at these megacities and urban conflict, Nick?
I think what ends up happening is when you move into those environments, ultimately it's the guy on the ground, it's the foot soldier that's going to be, you know, moving street to street and clearing. But in order to do that and have the capability to be successful, you need to leverage everything that you've got. And that includes using armor, it includes using field artillery, aviation assets. And if you don't have the capability to work together in a way that we haven't really seen since fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, I can tell you that, you know, during my deployments to Afghanistan, there was very minimal interaction with the ground guys. You know, I'm a helicopter pilot, and you would think there'd be a lot of coordination and planning, and it was pretty much just mission sets. You're going to pick some guys up flying from point A to point B, and that was about it. And I think we need to focus more on that kind of inter-branch coordination so that we can build that skill set back up and be able to fight in those environments.
Nick, I appreciate your call. David Kilcullen here. We are right back in that military headset. You know, you're talking flows and urban design, but Nick is listening. He's professional U.S. military. And he's thinking military intervention and what that's going to take. And please don't take the heavy stuff out of it, armor, aviation, all the rest. What are you thinking as you hear that, David?
Well, I actually, what Nick is saying makes an enormous amount of sense. I think there's a paradox here. So the environment is likely to be very different, and we've just been talking about that. And the military is not likely to be the best solution for dealing with it. But it's just a harsh historical fact that even though most people recognize that and always have, the U.S. military in particular gets sucked into these types of campaigns again and again and again. So right now, the military leaders, the Congress, the president are all saying we don't want to get into another Afghanistan or another Iraq. And I talk in the book about how there's been a whole succession of presidents in the 20th century that made basically exactly the same set of comments about every 20 years. And yet, once every 20 to 25 years, right back to the middle of the 19th century, the U.S. military has been dragged into a large-scale or long-duration operation against non-state armed groups, irregular conflict as we call it. So I see an enormous amount of operational continuity going forward. There's no reason to think that we will stop doing these kinds of interventions, and we need to be ready for them. But there's a very big environmental discontinuity, as we've been saying. The specific history of the U.S. military in the last decade is really important here, and Nick alluded to that. The U.S. military is one of the very few countries on the planet that saw any significant urban fighting in the last decade. When I deployed to Baghdad in February of 2007 at the beginning of the surge, at that time more than 50% of total combat action in the entire Iraq war was happening inside Baghdad city limits in a purely urban U.S. environment. And the U.S. military in particular in Iraq got very, very, very good at urban combined arms operations. But of course, not in a littoral environment, in a landlocked environment in the middle of the country. The British military in Basra did a little bit less fighting, but they were also engaged in a coastal environment. Leaving aside those two militaries, the other 50 countries that contributed forces to both Afghanistan and Iraq, the vast majority of the Western world's militaries, for them, the new normal is remote rural environments, whereas Nick said you don't have to bring in a lot of the same types of techniques that we've gotten very good at in places like Iraq. So I think there's a military challenge of thinking about what do we need to do for the future environment, but then there's a broader, frankly, a societal challenge where the military plays a role, but it's not the central actor. You know, what do we need to do about urban environments? And the military has to have its own internal debate about how to engage that.
And a lot of Americans, in any case, including legislators, as we saw in the recent Syria question, not wanting to be involved in much of a close-up way at all in a lot of these pictures. David Kilcullen's new book is Out of the Mountains, The Coming Age of the Urban Guerrilla. David, stand by in New York. I want to welcome into our conversation right now from Newark, Delaware, Mark Bowden,
national correspondent for The Atlantic, best-selling author, writer in residence at the University of Delaware, author of Black Hawk Down, famously, and much more recently, The Finish, The Killing of Osama Bin Laden. Mark Bowden, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
20th anniversary of the battle for Mogadishu and the events that you chronicled in Black Hawk Down. Do you see David Cullen describing a kind of Mogadishu future for a lot of the world? Is that, you know, sort of dense urban chaos on the coasts?
Well, I think he's right. You know, the trend for centuries now has been toward, you know, accelerating urbanization. So it just stands to reason that if American forces are called on to fight, that the better than even odds as we go forward that fighting will, you know, take place in cities. And I think, you know, the UN effort in Somalia in the early 1990s is probably a useful illustration of how the United States, as he was just saying, tends to get periodically drawn into these conflicts. So, yeah, to some extent, I think there's a lot of truth to it.
Do you think that with the voluminous and often bitter experience we've had in Baghdad and the rest in the years since then, is the U.S. better prepared for this now? And is prep, you know, some Americans today seem to feel like, don't be prepared because we just don't want to do it.
Well, we are far better prepared militarily and in terms of our intelligence agencies. Certainly to deal with non-state groups. I think that to some extent urban environments are offer certain advantages. I mean, for one thing, you know, urban environments are by definition cooperative. People need to cooperate with one another. There's a to whether it's an official or unofficial sense of community. You know, communities are there. If you're talking about Islamist fundamentalism, I think there's a reason why the hardcore Islamists have moved to remote, mostly rural or mountainous areas, and it's because they don't really thrive in big cities, which tend to be more liberal. People tend to be more Western. You know, there's a lot less popular acceptance of the sort of traditional rules that they want to impose. And I think that's one reason. In fact, you can look at more recently in Mogadishu, you know, the Shabab was chased out of those urban areas. Urban areas will remain targets for these terrorist groups, as Nairobi recently was, but they aren't particularly fertile grounds for that kind of non-state terrorists, but you know, there will be new strands for sure.
David Kilcullen, we just have half a minute before the break, but what about it? Maybe in your big, dense urban future, we'll have fewer of these violent non-state actors because they just won't be as tolerant, as nurturing a ground for them.
So, 2 points. Firstly, I agree with Mark that urban cores, you know, the central part of cities are generally not fertile ground for these types of groups, but there is an enormous aggregation of slum settlements now around the outside of old cities because of this urbanization phenomenon. You know, 250,000 Somalis in Nairobi, and that is much more fertile ground than the traditional city. And the second point would be, if you live in a big city and no one has enough to eat and there's a crime gang taking over your district and there's not enough electricity or fuel, for sure there might be a terrorist group out there in the environment, but that's not your major challenge. Your major challenge is all the stresses associated with urban growth, and I think that's where the new challenge is going to be.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking after Nairobi with counterinsurgency guru David Kilcullen about the world's population and our next conflict, he says, moving to our cities. His new book is Out of the Mountains, The Coming Age of the Urban Guerrilla. Mark Bowden is with us as well, author famously of Black Hawk Down, chronicling the battle for Mogadishu 20 years ago this week. Mark Bowden joins us today from Newark, Delaware. Of course, his latest book, The Finish, The Killing of Osama Bin Laden. This has all been in the air again recently with the attack on the mall, the Terror Mall in Nairobi. Here's Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta telling reporters that if Somali-based terrorist group al-Shabaab was hoping to send a message to Kenyan troops that they should get out of Somalia, Kenya would not back off. They're going to be in there, he said.
We went there to help them bring order in their own nation. And I want to be categorically clear. We will stay there until they bring order in their nation.
And that's Kenya. Will it be the U.S. next time? It certainly has been before. And we've seen urban violence come right to this country. April, two homemade bombs set off near the finish line of the Boston Marathon. Here are witnesses there from ABC News describing what they saw.
A large puff of smoke and then ultimate chaos, everybody running everywhere.
I saw quite a few casualties coming back. I saw one guy with his legs gone at the knees, some ankles and feet missing, shrapnel wounds on people on the sides of the head, and other things. It's just not good.
And that's right in the middle of urban USA. David, Mark, questions and comments. We asked on Facebook, we said, what's the lesson in the terror attack on the Nairobi Mall? Joe says, you're not safe anywhere. Patrick says, lesson is extreme income and political inequality creates violence. Kath says, safety is an illusion. USA, biggest arms dealer. We are not free until everyone is free. I mean, David, what about the politics here and issues of equity, resources, people feeling included beyond urban design and armaments? What about the, you know, don't basic politics set the table for this? Or is it a resource crowding issue and that's it?
Well, one of the things that I found as I was doing the research, and in particular as I was walking around Mogadishu last year talking to a lot of people, is that we look at populations that have recently come into an urban environment, like, for example, the Somalis in Nairobi and the Eastleigh slum, which is about 3 miles east of the mall that was attacked. And we tend to see those populations as marginalized. They're actually not marginalized in an economic sense. They're actually central to the functioning of the city. The labor force that does a lot of the menial and manual mm-hmm. tasks that make the city run come from those slums. The land where those slums sit used to be where the market gardens grew the food for the city and where the water catchment area was. So politicians that live in the urban core of a big city like that have to make deals and have to engage with populations there, including often non-state armed groups. And I'm not necessarily talking about al-Shabaab here. I'm talking about criminal gangs and organizations that dominate rackets that work in these environments. So there's definitely a very strong political element here. But I think the issue is when these communities are marginalized and disenfranchised, that is, they don't have the ability to have some kind of say about their own future or the opportunity to join the broader economic prosperity and liberalism of the city where they live, that's when you start to see major challenges. It's when a whole segment of society thinks, I'm never going to be able to join the party. I may as well just burn the house down. That's when you start to see outbreaks of large-scale urban violence. So I think it's about urban inclusion, but it's about giving people a role in the design of their own lives. Great example of this happened in Latin America, where a company called Elemental, which is an architecture firm, got families in slum areas to help design their own houses and their own communities and gave people a really strong design voice in the process of what happened to them. And I think we can look at that not only as a way of helping people that live in an urban environment that's struggling to cope, but also as a way of almost like a safety valve for preventing these kinds of very large-scale or intense kinds of outbreaks of violence.
Mark Bowden, David Cullen describes this rapid urban population growth, billions added to these coastal cities, you know, and then says, well, let's get into inclusion and good flow and all the rest. I mean, are we close to keeping up on that front? I mean, I know you're interested in the U.S. reducing its military footprint. That would suggest, you know, somebody better be interested from some other angles in this. 20 years ago, it was Mogadishu. I was there when the UN pulled out and the big blade from your chopper, one of them anyway, was still laying in the gutter trench there and still a lot of chaos. Are our politics and interventions to bring equity or stability anywhere near keeping up with population growth and its challenges, Mark?
No, they're not. And of course, David is exactly right. I mean, the ideal approach to any potential conflict is to deal with the root causes and try to ameliorate them before they become violent. And I think you know, he's absolutely right. It would be extremely desirable for world agencies, for the United States, to be focusing their energies and intelligence on coping with this rapid urbanization. And he's exactly right, I think, that there are potential problems, although I don't foresee Islamist fundamentalism being one of them. It's possible, but I don't think so. But I think, you know, the truth is that here in the United States, our federal government and our society has been very good at neglecting cities. Take a look at Detroit. You know, take a look at the public schools in most of the cities in the United States. We seem to be, as a country, be reluctant to invest in our own inner cities. And so the idea that suddenly we're going to become aggressive in globally addressing this problem, I think, is far-fetched.
Karachi looks a little beyond us. Michael in Springfield, Illinois is calling. Hi, Michael. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much. I wanted to add that, like some of your guests have said somewhat earlier, that this kind of fighting in urban environments isn't necessarily going to be anything new for you know, the U.S. military. My father was in World War II, and he was in the 104th Infantry Division that went across, you know, northern France, Belgium, and northern Germany. Mm-hmm. And the stories that he tells from the engagements that went on for the, you know, year plus that he was, you know, fighting across Europe, was that the armies would go into areas and they would set up on the edge of cities or outside of cities with their battalions, but it was the artillery and the tanks and the infantry that went into the cities and, you know, fought in this urban environment and, you know, in an attempt to sweep the German army out of a city. And so, you know, unlike what we think, you know, World War One and trench warfare, it really wasn't like that. It was kind of a more mobilized, you know, go into an area and then go into the cities. And, you know, he told some pretty harrowing tales of, you know, going into row houses and using explosives to blow down walls.
No, Michael, I don't doubt that a bit, and I'm glad he was able to come home to tell the story. But when you saw the mall in Nairobi, I mean, this is quite a different thing, isn't it? This is not a government that's hoping to leave blocks leveled. We all know that scene from Germany after the war. This is al-Shabaab, right? not the Nazi German army.
No, I agree. You know, you don't necessarily, you know, in a Nairobi situation want to have, you know, the army come and stand, you know, 20 miles off and just shell them all to the ground. You don't want to do that. But I guess my point is that the army at the time in World War II changed its tactics when they were on the ground to kind of meet, you know, the situation that they confronted with.
Yeah, and it was very urban, and we saw that. Let us pick it up, Michael. David, I mean, this was not howitzers and tanks, but the poor mall practically went to the ground anyway. I mean, there's a high value on getting this right.
We still don't know exactly what happened, but it seems that an RPG, a rocket fired by one of the Kenyan forces, may have hit a major column that broke the back of the roof and brought the roof down. I think where Mark was coming from, though, is urban fighting is not new, and I make that exact same point in the book. What I say is urbanization, population growth, and the tendency for things to be on coastlines, these trends have been around for thousands of years. There's nothing new about that. Mm. What is new is connectivity. In the last decade, and you fly over Mogadishu, or you fly over Tripoli, or you walk around La Rocinha outside Rio, you'll be astounded by the numbers of people with cell phones, the satellite television dishes, the cell phone antennas.
What's it matter?
It changes the way that conflict develops. And I have a whole chapter in the book where I talk about how the way that the Arab Spring developed is unlike any other example we've seen in the past because of access to connectivity. We had, you know, Libyan rebels doing transcontinental Skype hookups in order to plan their operations. We had electronic armies battling each other on the airwaves while soccer fans led fights against riot police on the street. In the case of Syria, we've had a very technically savvy and technologically literate population begin to design and field weapon systems that are as good as what the military has in backyard workshops based on their ability to download instructions off the internet.
Yeah.
It's really changing the way that conflict is operating. It's not the urban thing that alone is new. It's the addition of connectivity.
Mm.
Yeah, that's what changed it. Just one other thing. I know it's slightly off topic, but as I look at Syria, and we do track Syria very closely as part of the work that we do, one of the things that makes something like sarin gas or nerve agent very attractive to an oppressive regime like the Syrian regime is precisely that it doesn't damage the city. If you want to be the Russians in Grozny in 1994 and you're willing to level half of a city in order to fight a guerrilla, then you just bring up artillery and you shell the city.
Yeah.
If you don't want to destroy the urban fabric, it turns out nerve gas is a great tool for that because you can fire non-persistent nerve gas on the street, you can kill a couple of hundred people, and 5 minutes later on a warm day, the gas will already be dissipated to the point where you can send your own troops completely unprotected down that street and they'll be fine. So it's almost like a poor man's neutron bomb.
Well, talk about a terrible truth. A couple calls right here. Ethan in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Ethan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I guess this is going to be something that I will leave both of our guests with and our listeners just some food for thought. Going forward into the future, I think one of the major questions and also the major issue in some of these urban conflicts with these megacities is going to be the question of food and water supply. That will be, I think, both the source of major compromise between city governments, state governments, and these various non-state actor groups. It will also be the source of major contention because these large cities, you can't grow food inside them. You can't harvest food inside.
Mm-hmm. Well, you might end up growing some, but you got that sheer volume. Our time is short, Ethan, but that's a great issue. We'll bring it right up. I've got another caller right on the back of that, I think. Matt in Columbus, Ohio, you're on that.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for taking my call. I just had a question along the last caller. It seems to me Niobe might be a distraction, and really the future is going to be about large-scale slum riots and how that might affect our global economy. So I'm really interested in the flow model and how you might approach the kind of urban riot of the future.
The urban resource shortage, urban riot, and then this, Mark Bowden, David Cucullin, for both of you from Bill on Facebook says, if you take a city like Lagos or Rio or even Mexico City and double its size, where will the resources to run it come from? Fuel, water, electricity. Will not resource scarcity guarantee conflict? Mark Bowden, let me hand that first to you, this resource issue, right up to the slum riot and all the rest that we hear from our listeners.
Well, obviously, when you have a huge concentration of people, it does strain resources and it does demand a greater degree of cooperation and government planning in order to accommodate it. That said, people aren't stupid, and they will stop flocking to areas if the place is falling apart and you can't get food and can't get water. The reason people come to Eastleigh in Nairobi to these growing megaplexes is they're looking for work. They're looking for opportunity, and they're at least they believe that they'll find that opportunity there. So it does pose a great many problems. They're not insoluble ones, but I think it's a fact of life, and it's something that, as David points out, if we're smart as a country and as sort of civilized nations around the world, we will be paying more and more attention to it.
David, do you have an answer in flow terms for these huge volume issues of fuel and water and power and food?
Not an answer exactly, although I would say water is the critical one. You can last 3 weeks without food. If you don't have enough water, you're dead by sundown. So there's some serious issues around water across the whole planet, but in particular in urban environments. I finished writing the book about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very happy to see the media now starting to report something that I wrote about in the book, which is that when I was talking to Syrians about fighting in Syria, one of the key things people said to me was it was actually shortage of water that led to a lot of the riots, because every major city in Syria had been experiencing water rationing in 2010. Then there was a major drought, which led to refugees from drought-affected areas coming and swamping cities that already didn't have enough water. So there's a very strong correlation between lack of resources, particularly water, and conflict. But in terms of urban flow, and we don't have time to go into it in detail, but I spend a lot of time in the book exploring some ideas from urban ecology around urban metabolism, which is a well-understood element of urban design in terms of flows like water and carbon and fuel, but applying that to non-material flows like money and drugs and weapons and electricity to try to understand if we can model the way that cities function. And the short answer is you can. And there are useful things that you can do, and we've been doing them in Keras around a bunch of places across the world. But the solutions don't lie in the government. Things like Ceasefire Chicago, a community-based organization, the Crisis Mappers organization. There are a number of groups out there that are not the government that are actually really driving this debate, and I think it's one that we all need to be taking part in.
Well, all of this on a lot of people's minds lately between what we've seen in this country, Nairobi, Syria, all the rest. As we go from 6 to 9 billion on this planet, do we keep our cool? Do we not go dystopian? And what will that take? Mark Bowden's been opening our eyes to this kind of picture for a long time, with Black Hawk Down right up through his latest, The Finish, The Killing of Osama bin Laden. Mark, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
You're welcome, Tom.
And David Kilcullen, a counterinsurgency guru, now looking at a bigger urban picture globally. His new book is Out of the Mountains, The Coming Age of the Urban Guerrilla. Let's hope it's more than that. David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.